A stranger came up behind me, and these words he whispered in my ear. I can recall your face, mate, I don't remember your name. But I tell you where it was. He was tied to a tree up in Burma. And two Japs were flogging you well. They had these bamboo rods, and they sure could use them well. They swung them and brought them down across your chest, arms, and even across your face. They swung for about an hour, mate, before they finished their job. They threw the bamboos away and they laughed as they went on their way, and we came out in the jungle and undone the ropes and you fell. You landed in a heap, mate, and all that mud. We turned you over and you let out a moan. And we knew then that you had not gone. You was that weak you couldn't even stand, so we had to carry you back to camp. And we put you down on the ground and we left you there and went. But to our surprise the next morning, he was back on your feet and ready to go to work on that dreaded railway line. Well, we worked all day, and at the end of the day we came home. And as we were passing, we seen dirt coming up out of the ground. We walked over and we looked down that big hole. And who should be standing there but Weary Dunlop, 6'7", bone and muscle. And all he had on was a grin. I said, "Weary, what are you doing, mate?" And these are the words he said. "They call me a doctor." A latrine doctor. But that's not the words he said. Well, it's like this. When we came home, that's a job we've had to do. We'd have had to dig that latrine after our work was through. Then there was a time when we were blasting on the railway line. A stone got blown into my foot, and I had to get the knife from the ball to dig the stone out. It was just on time for going home. And to walk back from the railway line, well, I suppose we'd say it this way, would have been a little bit sore by the time I got home. When I got home, I had to face up to the doctor. This is a Japanese doctor they call Dr. Death. And he used to have a thing like a screwdriver with the end broken off. And when I got back, he probed and dug and, well, I suppose it really hurt. But this went on for about a week till someone told Weary Dunlop, and he came up. One night when I came home, this Dr. Death was doing his job, poking and probing. And Weary said, "Did it hurt?" And I said, "No." But everything was all right. He said, "One day I'll get in, and you can mark my words." It was only about 2 weeks after that that the Jap got the toothache. And he had to go up in front of Weary Dunlop. Weary Dunlop sat him down on a stump and got his big pliers and grabbed that tooth and held it well. Well, the boys in the camp told me that Jap squirmed and screamed, but Weary just held him firmly and didn't even move. Well, he held him there for quite a few minutes and he must have got tired. The boys told me he just picked him up by the tooth and held him and let him dangle. The boys said really it was just like someone catching a fish, and that Jap was dangling on the line. He was about a foot off the ground, both feet, and where he just held him there. He shook him for a moment until the tooth was released from the head and dropped on the ground. They reckon he got up and run like hell. Well, I heard all about it when I came back to camp, of how Weary had caught a tooth and pulled it right out of the Jap. Well, that was just like Colonel Dunlop. He's a mighty man, and everyone thought there were no one like him. We had another man in camp. He was about 6'4", one of Weary's mates, Ronald Ramsey Ray. He was a group captain, and he used to sing this song. And believe me, he had a voice. But this is how it went. Once I built a railroad, made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Buddy, can you spare a dime? And the first time we was down by the river, this is after the railway line had finished, and we were sitting there, and one lad had just swam across the river to go up to the native village to buy something for the sick. He'd just gone up one track, and a monkey came down the other, and he shook the bamboos and barked, well, for quite some time, and his mate came running down and sat down beside me, and he said, "Do you think you'll eat him?" And I said, "Oh, no, your mate will come back and get a knife and skin him before he eats him." And he said, "Not me mate eating the monkey, me monkey eating my mate." As those monkeys are pretty big, about 6 foot more in height, and they weigh a few hundred pounds by their size. When we were captured in Java, they took us back and threw us in a cage. Oh, there were some people there, Javanese, Menardinese, Malayans, Chinese. We were left for days, we never got a drink. And at the end of the time, the Australians were the only ones who came out alive. I think the truth of the matter was that they thought it was the wrong way for an Australian to go. Instead of leaving him in that cage to die, they might as well torture him to death. So they took us into this building, and that's where things really began. They put a rope around your throat, a loop on the end, put it down the back of the seat. Your feet were tied up tightly and pulled up the back of the chair. And then to add to your discomfort, they put a cord around your head. This cord has one loop in one end and a peg in the other. Well, they put it round your head, and then they begin to twist. And this is something that really does disturb one, as your head starts to shrink. It cracks, and it feels as if it's going to crumble. And they keep repeating the same old thing about all the defence positions around Australia, places where you'd never been. Well, we get this for days and days, and on it goes. The defence positions all around Australia, until at the end of the time They release you and they send you back to your camp. That is just one of the tortures that really happened. And these things, it's on this tape, is really true. But this is something you might be able to tell me. I can never work it out. How people can walk through Melbourne and go crooked, what the Japanese, or what happened to the Japanese, I should say, Hiroshima, when they dropped that bomb. You see, 24 hours before any bomb dropped in Japan, and this is really true because I was there and I know what I'm talking about. But 24 hours before a bomb was dropped, you were told. We were in Osaka at the time. But they dropped the bomb in Hiroshima and everyone was going crook about that. But no one seems to worry about all those people that died along the line, and the people, kiddies and women, were put in little cages and taken out to the sea and tied there until the tide came in. There were hundreds of thousands of people that died that way, just been put in a basket and tied down onto these poles they've got in Singapore. I suppose they're still there today. But see, that's how they disposed of bodies, and hundreds of thousands. And along that railway line, well, when that cholera season came, to get away from the railway line, you had to climb over bodies. Now, this is true. This is no hooey at all. This is really authentic. Weary Dunlop can verify this. A lot more of the mates there came back, though there are not too many left now. But people can say, we done this and we done that, and we don't give a damn. There's one thing they don't worry about, is the soldier. That was the fighting man. The one who came home. It's bad enough people had died for nothing. And they really did. They died for nothing. As Japan never really lost the war, they really won the war, in my mind, because they've got everything. And we haven't even got a dime. See, Bert, you can go to the doctor and you can tell him. It took me 16 years to go in front of a doctor because I didn't want to have anything to do with him. I wanted to keep away until I got really crook. And then when I went back, they told me there was nothing wrong with it, just old age. See, when I came back, I never went to a doctor. I suppose that's where I am really wrong. But I'd been told what others went through and the humiliation they went through just to get a few bob. And I battled on and worked in quarries. In fact, when I first came back, I had my job to go to in Dunlop's. But they didn't want me back. In the 5.5 years that I had really gone, they had another man to take my job, which we can't really blame. But then when you come back, you're told, and the things they wrote in the paper, and this is really true, that how they paid for the men that went away and what they were doing for them when they came back. Well, when I came back after 5.5 years, they said I had £14.10 to pick up. That was for all the money it was made up while I was away. So I told them to stick it in the poor box. That was the best thing to do. And I signed the cheque so they could put it in the poor box. But Mum said it was the worst thing I ever done. I should have given to truth and let them find out for sure what really happened to people that went away to fight their war. Then I went to Strathmerton, and there I worked falling trees, cutting logs, posts, strainers, and put blocks. Until one day I came back from the bush, and I'm having a drink of beer, and one of these big mouthed people yelled out and told me they would shoot my dog. Well, I suppose really when you first come home you are really strange, because I thought at that time, well, if he shot my dog, I'd shoot him. So I told him, and everyone laughed. They thought it was a joke. But what they didn't know, I really meant what I had said. So I go home after having a few drinks. But there was an old chap that was standing beside me, had got out and gotten his tinker, and he'd gone home. But by the time I got home, he was at my place waiting there. I didn't know what it was all about, but apparently he'd wanted a couple of rabbits. And Mum gave me half a dozen bullets, told me she wanted pork for the dogs, and that this chap had wanted a couple of rabbits to take home. So he told me that if I could shoot six rabbits with six bullets, that he'd give me the best sporting rifle I'd ever seen. So I shot my six rabbits, took them home, and I noticed he picked them over, and I wasn't taking that much notice. But then the next day I go to work, and I come back, and I pull into the pub to have a couple of drinks before I went home. But this time, I'm not a black so-and-so like he had already told me. I was Mr. Ritchie. And he was very sorry for what he'd said. But everyone's talking about this fella had shot six rabbits, six bullets. A rabbit running towards him was shot between the eyes, run away from him, was shot right between the ears. And I said, "Lie good, this fellow's good. I'd like to see him shoot." And one fella told me, "It's you they're talking about." I tried to convince them that most of those rabbits had been sitting there, and all I had to do was shoot them right between the ears. But no, they wouldn't take the truth from me, because after all, this man had been there and seen what happened. The man who had the big mouth, who was yelling about what he'd do, he went across the road and told the sergeant of police that I was going to shoot him. And the sergeant of police came over, and he tried to make me understand. He said, "Look, there's lots of people," he said, "that mightn't even like that man." He said, "Now, if one should shoot your dog, what would you really do?" Well, I must have thought I had all the time in the world, because this is what I said to him. "I'll shoot him, and then I'll find out who really shot my dog." And I said, "I'll shoot him as well, and that'll even up the score." When we came back from the Burma line, we had to go back to Singapore, and we were picked up on a ship. Actually, it was only two-thirds of a ship. The front had been blown away. So they welded a big plate, a flat plate, right across the face of where the ship was originally cut off. And we sailed in the wake of another ship to Japan. Then, when we landed at Kobe, we went from on the railway line down to Osaka. That was the end of our line. Because then we were taken to a camp where we had to work in a mine, a copper mine. And there we lived for about a year before the day we were released. But I must tell you about the mine. From the day you start till the day you come home, you could work, say, 12 hours, 24 hours, 36 hours a day before you really got home. But down the mine, you got nothing on, only a smile. But it's very, very hot, even when there's snow on top when you go in. You get in about 3 miles into the mountain, and then you go down below. You go down hundreds of meters before you reach the landing you're on. And then you work there until the time they tell you that you're allowed to come up. But the Japs are allowed up to see the sun, whether sunrise or sunset, because they worship the sun. Then they come back, and on you, away you go, back to work, and keep on until the next day. The times when the roof caved in, he was buried inside, and the Japs and the Australians would work just to get you out. If you was hurt, I must admit, the Japs looked after you, but if you happened to be all right, well, it was just too bad. And that's really true. Because they'd flog you. They used to have these little steel bars they used to carry around. And by God, they used to try to bend them. Didn't matter if it was over your head, your back, shoulders. But they used to wield them well. And many a time you wished that you'd been dead instead of come out. There was a time when I had to crawl into a hole to put a shot in there to blow the stuff out. There was between two landings, and all the ore used to be put in there. So the Jap lit the fuse, and I crawled into the hole, and by the time I placed it, a shot went further up in one of the landings and blew the stuff down around my leg, and I couldn't get my leg out. I couldn't get to the fuse because it was too far up the hole, and I couldn't get out because I was held there by the leg. And my mate tried to pull me out because the boulders were too big to even move, and I asked him if he could get a shovel so he could cut my leg off so I could get out, because I only had a couple of minutes to go. And away he went, and he came back, and he pulled and heaved and tugged, and I said, "Look here, Bronk, it's no use the two of us going this." But no, he wouldn't move. He just had to stick around to see where I was going, I suppose, just to keep an eye on me. And I said, "Now, if this was the other way around, I'd leave you there. Don't worry about that." He said, "Oh, well, we'll just stick around and see." And as he was pulling me, another shot went further up. And as it went off, he pulled, and I was pulled right out. I more or less went out and round the corner at the same time when the explosion went off. And we were covered in dust and showered with stone. But luckily for us, we was round the corner and we didn't stop the blast. So that can just tell you what some of your mates are like. They won't leave you to the last. Then there was a time when the Yanks flew overhead and they dropped these pamphlets to tell us they were in English, Italian, you name it, and they were in that. To get out of the place 24 hours. Well, when it was time to bomb Osaka, they decided to take us down to the refineries right in town. And I suppose they knew it while we were up in the mines that nothing could happen to us. So we're taken down to refineries and put in there to work. And that was when our doctor found out sulfur. So I told him that we had plenty in that refinery. So he gave me his haversack and I took it the next day. I took it to the refineries and I filled it right to the top. And when we came back, yes, you guessed it, there was a search party waiting for us there. And they searched us and eventually it came to me and they opened up my haversack and we had it filled up with sulfur. So I tried to explain to the interpreter what it was all about, but I was taken and hung up by the arms and pulled up on the jib. I hung there for 2 hours and got flogged a bit at the time. Then after it was all over, I was taken inside. And when I woke up the next morning, I found out the doctor hadn't got these stuff. So because I'd got my flogging, I thought I'd go back and I'd recover the sulfur. So they took me and hung me up again and started the same old flogging. Just to remind you, it's stealing from the Imperial forces was the wrong thing to do. The one Jap came in, we used to call him King Kong, because he was a man about 7 foot tall and his arms used to hang down past his knees and he looked one of the most vicious people you ever seen, but he had a heart as big as him. And he could talk a bit of English and he told me it was definitely a crime to steal anything from the Imperial forces, that I should have asked him. So I thought, well, that's all right, because anything I ever want, I'll go and see him, and, well, that's what it's all about. So the next day, I found out the doctor couldn't do his job with the sulfur because he needed petroleum jelly. And I said, well, we've got plenty of that in the refinery. So I got his bag again, I filled it up, and believe it or not, the Japs were waiting for us again. So this time I told them it was King Kong that he gave me the stuff. Although, honestly, Bert, I couldn't find him, and I looked around enough. Because when you've been hung up by the arms for a couple of hours, it's very hard for you to get your arms down again. You've got to lie on the ground and dig your toes into the ground and push yourself up till your arms come down. Well, I'll leave it at that, Bert. And if you want to put it to the air, God bless you and your child, son. Let's hope there's never, not another war.